Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Podcast. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Because together we can learn so much. Well, welcome everybody, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. Hope that you've had a good week so far. You know, today on The Healthy Mind, I was ready. I knew what I wanted to talk about. I had it all set in my mind, took notes, and then I got an email. I got an email from a friend of mine. Her name is Georgie Oldfield. She's in the UK, and she runs a program called SIRPA. S-I-R-P-A, and I really, really invite you to take a look at SIRPA. It stands for Stress Illness Recovery Practitioners Association, and Georgie's an amazing individual. She has dedicated the last several years of her life to getting SIRPA going in the UK. It's one of the few programs out there that really takes professionals, clinicians, and teaches them about how our emotions, our stress, can impact our physical. A lot of what we talk about here on The Healthy Mind, the idea that emotions can cause physical symptoms, particularly physical pain. And in this particular email, Georgie was talking about the fact that she had just finished a SIRPA practitioner's course for new practitioners, which she runs throughout the year. Well, one of the people that was trained in this particular course was then talking to a professor who specializes in pain. The professor who specializes in pain. And he said, quote, "If someone has had pain for more than 6 months, then you can't cure it. And that we need to be blunt with patients and tell them outright that they are never going to get rid of the pain and that they are going to have to learn to self-manage it." End of quotes. Chronic pain not gone within 6 months.
It is never going away.
At least according to this particular professor who specializes in pain. Well, needless to say, this happened to catch my eye, to put it as mildly as I can. And after I said a few choice expletives out loud to my computer monitor, I thought, well, okay, suddenly the topic for the podcast today has changed. And we are going to talk about this. We're going to talk about chronic pain. And really, for those of you that struggle with chronic pain, how you must not let people, particularly professionals, doctors, physicians, whoever they may be, I don't care if they're specialists in chronic pain, ever tell you that something will not go away for the rest of your life. It's preposterous, first off, with the level of advancement that we are having in the sciences. I mean, it is exponential. Say nothing about what has happened in pain sciences, the science of pain, the study of pain, the physiology and emotions of pain that has just happened in the last decade. That is an incredibly, incredibly short-sighted statement to make, that pain will never go away. Just doesn't work that way. And if you've been a listener of the Healthy Mind podcast for some time, if you have, I really do appreciate it. If you're new, welcome. You're really here on a good day. We are going to be talking about my particular area of interest, the fact that chronic pain a lot of times may not have very much, if anything, to do with injury or physiology or anatomy. Oh, yeah, yeah, you heard that right. And I'm not just going to give you my opinion or the fact that my treatment and others in this field has helped people with chronic pain, some who have suffered for decades get better, but the fact that there are studies out there that run contrary to the fact that at least what modern medicine is doing, we don't really know exactly what's happening with pain. And if we don't know exactly what's happening with pain, then how can we ever, ever begin to make statements like,
it is never going away.
Chronic pain, don't ever let them tell you it is forever. This week on The Healthy Mind. In news, a couple of great news stories out there, some studies that really are up my alley and really related to this theme. The first one, handling stress, how your emotional style may be creating anxiety, how our personality can affect our anxiety, and I would argue even physical symptoms. So we'll talk about some of the best methods for dealing with stress out of this new study in the second half of the podcast. And secondly, you all know here that I am a huge, huge fan of fish oils and omega-3 fatty acids. Well, here's another potentially healthy benefit for fish oils. Can fish oils reverse the brain-damaging effects of junk foods? You know, those high-fat, high-calorie, high-sugar-rich, delicious foods that we love to eat. Oh yeah, I love them too. Can fish oils help to reverse some of the actions that it has on the brain? Some really fascinating, fascinating new research on fish oils and the brain. We're going to do some headlines, and hey, you just happen to have stumbled onto a fantastic podcast today. I'm really happy that you are here. So, are you ready? Let's begin. Okay, now, chronic pain. And again, for those of you who may be new to the Healthy Mind, one of my biggest areas of interest in psychiatry is the way that we tend to express our emotions in the form of physical symptoms, particularly pain and discomfort. There's so much that we don't understand about pain. Even with all of the advancements that we have had in the last two decades or so, it seems, as I tell my patients all the time, the more we learn about pain, well, the less we know. But this particular email that I had gotten regarding a very, very bold and what I would say short-sighted statement of this particular pain professor, wherever he may be, that if someone has had pain for longer than 6 months, it's not going away. Ever. Ever.
It is never going away.
I just think it's a bunch of hogwash. I mean, it runs counter to even what we know about pain today, that doesn't hold water, let alone in terms of adding in the psychological aspects of physical pain and chronic pain. There is so much that we have learned in the last few years that is really a time of great promise as it relates to physical pain. But more specifically, in the work that I and others who share the same type of passion have done, particularly through the work of Dr. John Sarno in tension myositis syndrome and those of us in the PPDA, the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association, and we've talked about some of those individuals as well, Dr. David Clark, Dr. Howard Schubiner, Dr. Fran Anderson, Dr. Eric Sherman, Dr. Ira Rashbaum, and Alan Gordon. There is a whole discipline out there that looks at pain and the role of emotions in the pain response. And not that it is a contributing factor to the intensity of pain. Well, yeah, I'm depressed, so of course my pain is going to hurt more. But something deeper than that. The fact that our emotions can and often do create physical symptoms, physical pain. Now, why on earth would physical pain be created simply out of emotions? And again, this is theory, but this theory has helped millions. And I'm not saying that to be dramatic. Literally, look up John Sarno, S-A-R-N-O-M-D, and what you will find is he is one of the most popular authors of all time on Amazon.com. Top 1,000 authors of man's history. The simple theory that our emotions, unwanted emotions, whether it is anger or rage or anxiety or what I believe to be existential issues of anxiety, our loneliness, our mortality, our meaning, and our freedom in life, those can be very, very raw and uncomfortable feelings. And what our brains will do, because we're survivors, because we want to live, is that it will utilize any mechanism possible to protect ourselves from those emotions because they may be a threat. If we're out in the wild and a lion is chasing after us, our body knows exactly what to do in the moment. Blood moves from the center of our body out to our legs and we start running and our heart starts beating and we breathe deeper so we've got enough oxygen to get to our blood to get the heck out of there. All of this happens automatically, instantly, in an effort to escape a threat. And we survive. Now, what is happening here, very similarly, at least those of us who do this type of work, is these unwanted emotions, these terrifying emotions. Terrifying in the sense that they threaten us for whatever reason. We perceive them as a threat. When those emotions, unwanted, terrifying, frightening emotions, have a chance, threaten to come up into our consciousness, well, it's like that lion that we're faced with. Our body sees the threat and it is going to move into action to protect ourselves from that threat. And boom! We begin to feel physical pain. Pain here in psychophysiologic disorders or TMS, tension myositis syndrome. That type of pain is a protective, it is a survival based pain. In our mind, we think it is easier and less suffering for me to feel the physical pain as a survival-based distraction than it is to uncover those emotions. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. What are you talking about, Zafiridis? That is a bunch of BS. You, sir, are a charlatan. Okay. Believe me, I'm a psychiatrist. I deal with criticism every single day. You don't really go into psychiatry if you have an issue with people being critical of the validity of your profession. But I would argue that some of the basic understandings, the reason that people understand that they are in physical pain, and also the reason that they go and get surgery and procedures on their backs and their necks, well, that's a bunch of flawed understanding as well. You know, those things called disc bulges and disc protrusions and stenosis of the nerves that cause all different types of pain, and people are terrified into getting back surgeries and various procedures where they literally remove your vertebral discs from your body and then fill that with cadaver bone. Well, turns out, if you really look at some of the data, not too convincing that those findings really cause pain at all. Oh yeah, they don't cause pain at all. Now, where's the proof? You can look this up online for yourself. You can just look up or Google asymptomatic patients with positive MRI findings. Now, in English, those are patients that have absolutely no back pain that have been researched in studies, but yet have findings on MRI in their backs. A person who has absolutely no back pain, no neck pain, yet the radiologist who reads the MRI says, well, there's a huge disc bulge. There's cervical stenosis, there's lumbar stenosis, the nerves are compressed. There are broken vertebrae and degenerative changes in the spine. And these are the bases for which decisions are made every single day on whether or not people get back surgery. But if you look at it, first off, there are more than enough studies to suggest that, not very convincing data that proves that what you see is the reason why you're in pain. Wait. There's another conundrum. What do you do with the person who is in chronic pain and you get an MRI and nothing is found? Clean MRI, beautiful discs. Well, here in medicine, the response is psychological factors are clearly involved here, which is really code for doctors saying, we really have no idea why this person's in pain. And yet, for those individuals who have pain and decisions are made based on imaging studies or findings that have really shown an inconsistent track record of proving or predicting that those are the reasons that pain is occurring, well, it's pretty rock solid medicine. Let's not involve psychological factors in this, Peter. Now, what I am talking about doesn't prove the psychological basis for pain, but the theme today is chronic pain. Don't ever let them tell you it's forever. Because it's not. We are not that advanced yet in medicine to utter a statement like, if you have chronic pain that has not gone away within 6 months, well,
it is never, going away.
Now, let me give you some data, some evidence in which I base some of my thoughts and my feelings about chronic pain, what we know and what we don't know. The first study, and this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Jensen and Modick are the researchers. And what they wanted to see was that, what if we take a bunch of people who have absolutely no back pain at all, zero, and run them through the MRIs? Let's see what the radiologists read out. Is anything really going to show up on MRI? I mean, these folks have no back pain. Probably nothing. It's going to be a clean MRI of their back, right? Well, no, that isn't the case. A full 64%, more than half, had abnormal disc findings on their MRIs. The discs between their vertebrae were abnormal. They might have been bulging, they might have been protruding, they might have been full extrusion of the disc, causing pain, or so we think. There were other findings as well. Some of the things that are commonly thought to cause back pain. Things like degenerative disease of the joints, spondylolysis, things like spondylolisthesis, and stenosis, or pressing of the nerves. The majority of people in this study had abnormal findings, yet none of these individuals, zero, had any back pain. What is going on here? There was another study. This was done by Dr. Norbert Boos, who won awards for this study that was published in the Journal of Spine. And what he decided to do was to say, okay, there might have been a problem with this Jensen study. I'm going to take people who are high risk, those people who may have high risk occupations that maybe predispose them to injuries or back problems. But he took all of these individuals, high risk people, no back pain at all, zero. And he wanted to see, all right, now do these people have disc problems? Do you have a feeling about what I'm about to tell you? 76% of these high-risk occupation people with absolutely no back pain had problems that were identified on the MRI of their discs. 76% were read out with disc problems. And with regards to degenerative disc disease, DDD, we know all about that. 85% of the group with no back pain had confirmed degeneration of the disc, at least at one level. Ladies and gentlemen, these disc herniations and degenerative changes in the discs are the basis by which physicians will say, you've got to go and get a back surgery or injections. But yet, there are people in these studies and other studies, you can look online, there's many of them, that really call into question the disc findings by MRI as the reason that a person is in pain. So what's going on here? What is going on here? Well, part of it could be that there are multiple factors that lead to a pain response. But there's the other part too. The folks that I see and who get better are the folks who come in and nothing is wrong with their studies. They've had terrible back pain for weeks or years or decades. And there's nothing wrong with their scans, their labs, their tests. They're quote-unquote normal. But what's happening here? I would argue that emotional factors are critical and at least need to be thought of early on in the person who's being treated for pain, acute or chronic pain. Don't get me wrong. You get a fracture, someone breaks their leg, breaks their arm, there's going to be pain. I'm not talking about that. But when there's not a good reason for an injury or no injury that's been found or that has occurred, yet a person has had pain, then we've got to look at all of this, because even the state of the science as it is today, this kind of neuromatrix of pain that we are understanding today, is that emotions themselves, when you hurt somewhere and that comes up to your brain to say, ow, that hurts, the level of your emotions, whether you're happy or you're sad, are going to act like volume knobs. And if you're sad or upset or angry, that pain that's coming up there is going to feel like, ow! A 7 or an 8 on a scale from 1 to 10, where 10 is the worst pain. Yet if you're happy, feeling good, in a good mood, that might be like, ow, a 2 or a 3. So we already know that emotions definitely play into it, even with the state of the science today. But yet, Dr. Sarno started to talk about this theory that our emotions can actually create pain. And we know that. Work has been done that really does prove that our emotions, especially when they're good, act like pain medications. We can release natural opioids in our body that helps blunt the pain. But negative emotions, or at least the threat of these negative emotions coming to consciousness, oftentimes can be the cause of the pain. Because of unwanted emotions, or frightening emotions, or terrifying emotions, or terrifying trauma, our mind and body will do whatever it needs to protect itself. And for some people, it's going to be physical pain. I always use the example of those unfortunate cases of physical or sexual abuse in which you see someone develop multiple personalities. And people can understand why that may happen. Something is so traumatic, so difficult for the mind to process, that it literally creates a separate personality that is walled off from others to protect itself from something so bad. And the way that I understand TMS or PPD is that our mind will do whatever it needs to protect itself, including physical symptoms, because the emotions underneath are more threatening. Now, we're only beginning to get data that this, in fact, is happening. Classic work by one of our fellow colleagues, Dr. Howard Schubiner, who shows a program that he utilizes in his book, Unlearn Your Pain, has scientific evidence that his method relieves pain. No surgeries, no medicines. And really, if you look at the long-term data on back pain, those that have surgery versus those that do nothing at all, except maybe physical therapy, conservative treatment, long-term, there really isn't a whole lot of difference in the outcomes. So I ask you, what in the heck is going on here? How much of this is emotions versus physical problems, anatomical, biological, physiological problems that cause pain? The data isn't convincing, or at the very least, there is challenging data, good data, that says, wait a minute, you can't with certainty, just because you see something on the MRI, assume that that is the reason that you have pain. And it's probably why we see so many people after surgery, after these procedures, continue with their back pain. and why many, many people over the years, especially those who have followed some of the work of John Sarno, have seen dramatic changes in their lives simply by understanding the psychology of pain, the way that our emotions will protect ourselves by utilizing physical pain. I'm one of those believers. And that is what I talk about and the folks that I treat. Not because it's just an interest of mine, but because I suffered the exact same thing. And it was the work of Dr. Sarno and many others at the time, not a surgery or an injection, that brought me from terrible back pain to health. To health. And I'm not on a crusade here to make sure that I am right. If it helps some people, fantastic. If it doesn't, I understand. But to dismiss it completely, the emotional part of this, where the very latest of our data is showing this complex interplay between the emotional and the physical, not just pain, but cardiovascular disease, gastrointestinal disease, hormone problems, inflammatory problems. You cannot make statements. I don't care if you're a pain specialist and say, after 6 months, you just need to tell the patient that they're never going to get better. Huh. Forget it. If you don't like what you're hearing from your doctor or your health professional, or you're confused, challenge us. Ask questions. There's no disrespect. It's your health and welfare. And anyone who is worth their salt is not going to take that as an insult. They're going to see it as someone who wants to understand what is going on in their health and why the doctor or health professional is going to use this treatment to make it better. I think that's an absolute obligation and right of everyone as a patient. So when we start to look at that and utilize some of these techniques, we start to see that pain is malleable. It's not fixed. It's not your destiny. It is if your thought patterns are that way. And that's the danger of someone like that who just makes these declarations. It changes the meme. And if you don't believe you can, well, then you can't. But if you truly believe that change is possible, and that it is, I can't emphasize that enough, that change is possible in our health and in our emotions, you begin to empower yourself and things begin to change. They do. They will. Don't ever let them tell you it is forever. And never doubt how truly powerful you are. Once you realize that, oh, you are well on your way. You've taken more than one step. You are already walking down that path to the healthy mind. And now it's time for news. Okay, well, a busy week of health news. Now, this first news piece, are you a glass half empty or glass half full kind of person? Well, would you believe that how you see that glass may tell you a lot about how you handle anxiety? Oh, yeah, it's true. The headline, Handling Stress, How Your Emotional Style May Be Creating Anxiety. This was a new study that came out of the University of Illinois. And the researchers there wanted to see, well, how do people handle stress? And does personality or their style of how they see adversity or challenge tend to cause problems? Is it better if you express your feelings or if you are a stuffer? And what they found was that individuals who used a strategy, and I'll explain it here in a minute, of reappraisal experienced less anxiety than those who suppressed their feelings. A little bit of what we're talking about earlier here on the podcast, that a lot of times stuffing our feelings can lead to some of those physical symptoms like pain. But here what they studied was the emotional symptoms, expressing versus suppressing. It involved about 180 men and women, and the research team analyzed the results to see if different emotional strategies had any effect on the individual's anxiety. And what they found was those individuals who engaged in an emotional strategy, a regulation strategy called reappraisal, they tended to have less social anxiety and less anxiety in general than individuals who tended to avoid expressing their feelings. Now, what is this reappraisal? And basically, reappraisal is looking at a problem, whatever it may be, adversity or a challenge, in a new way. Now, one of the University of Illinois graduate students who was involved in this study, Nicole Llewellyn, described reappraisal. She said, quote, "You sort of reframe and reappraised what's happened and think, what are the positives about this? What are the ways I can look at this and think of a stimulating challenge rather than a problem?" End of quotes. And we've talked about this before here on The Healthy Mind, kind of one of my favorite quotes in the world, Ralph Waldo Emerson's, "Every wall is a door." We learn from failure and adversity. And that's kind of what reappraisal is all about. And we know that anxiety disorders are huge, huge problem in America and throughout the world. Almost 20% of U.S. adults is going to be afflicted with some type of anxiety disorder that it either warrants a diagnosis or a treatment. And we know that not all anxiety is bad, but when we have anxiety that gets in our way, it can prevent us from enjoying our life and getting things done. Expressing our feelings is critical. It's critical not only for just getting those emotions out, but when we chronically suppress or stuff our feelings. It's not that we get away from it. Just stopping or not thinking about it or forgetting it doesn't mean you get a pass. It can manifest itself as depression or as anxiety. And at least as this study has shown, a technique like reappraisal, there's a stressor, there's a problem, I'll look at it in a different light. What can I learn from this? Maybe the difference between having anxiety that can really cause problems and feeling happy. Reappraisal as a means of dealing with anxiety. Okay, well, those of you who listen to The Healthy Mind regularly know I am a huge, huge fan of omega-3 fish oils. I take them regularly every single day, as do my children. And there are so many health protective and healthy benefits of fish oils, mostly because of its anti-inflammatory effect and how it can impact cardiovascular health, inflammatory health, and even depression. Well, a new study out of the University of Liverpool has found maybe yet another healthy benefit of fish oil. The headline, "Can fish oil reverse the brain-damaging effects of junk food?" And what these researchers found was that adding oily fish or fish oil supplements to your diet actually could prevent some of the damage that occurs from us eating junk food. Those high-fat, high-sugar, high-calorie-containing foods that aren't so good for us. Fish oils can actually help to suppress some of those negative effects. Now, what this team did was they looked at almost 200 studies, 180 research papers, and what they found was that fish oils can minimize the effects that junk food has on the brain. Now, why? How is this happening? How is this possible? Well, if you look at the research over the last 10 years or so, it's found that high-fat diets disrupt what's known as neurogenesis. And neurogenesis is a process by which we generate neurons or new nerve cells. It prevents that process from happening in its most optimal way. But diets rich in omega-3s, like fish oils, could prevent these negative effects by stimulating the area of the brain that controls our feeding, our learning, and our memory. And because of this, we may be able to reverse some of the potentially negative effects of foods that are high fat and really junk foods. Now, the fish oils themselves don't work directly in that area of the brain. But what they do is they stall the ability of these sugars and these fats to block the brain's control of how much food we consume, when we eat those, it makes us think that, God, we can eat more and more and more. Well, the fish oils come in there and block that response. Now, one of these researchers, Dr. Lucy Pickavance from the University of Liverpool, says, quote, these changes can be seen in the brain structure, including its ability to generate new nerve cells, potentially linking obesity to neurodegenerative diseases. Research, however, has suggested that omega-3 fish oils can reverse or even prevent these effects. End of quotes. Now, there's been a lot more data that confirms that high-fat diets and high-sugary diets increase inflammatory molecules in fats like triglycerides. In fact, we've talked about this in the role of obesity as well as diet on emotions and depression. If you have a chance, and I'd highly, highly recommend it, my podcast with Dr. Vladimir Maletic, when we discuss the biology of depression and the role of inflammation in diets, including fish oil, in the brain and in helping depression. The title of that podcast, if you're searching for it, is appropriately named The Biology of Depression. It really is worth your time. Now, why does this happen? And it's thought that high-fat diets will decrease the ability of brain-protecting hormones to really reach the brain. And this neurogenesis, the production of these new nerve cells, is decreased. And the existing nerve cells can suffer damage. Now, diets rich in omega-3s are anti-inflammatory, and they can interfere with the production of these inflammatory molecules. They can also suppress triglyceride. And because of that, it's thought this is some of the protective mechanism that allows neurogenesis, or the formation of new nerve cells, to continue. Back to Dr. Pickavance, quote, fish oils don't appear to have a direct impact on weight loss, but they may take the brakes off the detrimental effects of some of the processes triggered in the brain by high-fat diets. They seem to mimic the effects of calorie-restrictive diets, and including more oily fish or fish oil supplements in our diets could certainly be a positive step forward for those who want to improve their general health. You can read more about this study on the website at thehealthymind.com. And really, if you're interested in the fish oils and the effect of diet and inflammation on our mood and depression, a couple of really important interviews on the website that I have done. First, Dr. Maletic, The Biology of Depression, and also my interview with Dr. Barry Sears, Fish Oil and Your Mood. A couple of really important interviews if you're interested in fish oils and the role of fish oils in your health. Okay, with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline. I'm sorry I am running long with the podcast this week. The headline, can breastfeeding protect against ADHD? A team of Israeli researchers has found that breastfeeding may protect against the development of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder later in childhood. The next headline. Serotonin mediates exercise-induced generation of new nerve cells. Now, we talked about that earlier in neurogenesis. And what these researchers have found was that exercise stimulates the growth of new nerve cells, neurogenesis, and that the neurochemical serotonin, also implicated in our mood, is an important part of the reason that neurogenesis happens. And finally, I just love this one. I had to include it. Do you have a lucky shirt, a lucky jersey when you're watching a football game or a baseball game or a soccer game or a certain part of the couch that you have to sit in? Well, it's an illusion. The headline, Illusion of Control, Why Sports Fans Prefer Lucky Products. Individuals engage in superstitious behavior when they want to achieve something, but they don't have the power to make it happen. This, according to new research from both Tulane and Columbia University. I don't care what the researchers say. I know what I need to wear so that my Steelers, my Pittsburgh Steelers, get to the Super Bowl. The studies be damned. Go Steelers. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's just about going to do it for this week's podcast of The Healthy Mind. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. Thank you as well for taking the time to rate the podcast on iTunes. If you haven't done so yet and you appreciate the podcast, I would really appreciate it. It really makes a huge, huge difference when just a few people go over and rate the podcast on iTunes. It would mean so much to me if you could do that kindness for me. Thank you ahead of time if you do that. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. I tweet at Dr. Zafiridis. And any questions or comments, you can always be in touch with me. Thank you for those beautiful emails. The email address, peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.